By such methods, they gradually eliminated one little misery after another. At last, on May the 2nd, 8 days after the Caird had sailed, and more than 2 weeks after their arrival, the sun came out. The men hurriedly carried their sleeping bags outside to spread them out to dry. It was clear again on the 3rd, and on the 4th. Even after 3 days of sunshine, their sleeping bags were not completely dry, though the improvement was a notable one. "We are already much drier than we ever expected to be again," James wrote. There were lengthy debates about how long it would take the Caird to reach South Georgia, and how long after that it would be before a rescue ship arrived. The most optimistic figured that by May the 12th, a week hence, they might expect to see a ship. More conservative guesses said that it would be June the 1st, before there could be any thought of rescue. But again, it was a matter of fighting back hope. Even as early as May the 8th, long before they could expect anything to have happened, all of them were already worrying about whether the ice conditions around the island might prevent a relief ship from approaching. This anxiety had a solid basis in fact. The month of May, the equivalent to November in the Northern Hemisphere, was already one quarter over. Winter was only a matter of weeks, possibly days, away. When it did arrive, there was a strong possibility that ice might form completely around the island and thwart any attempts to bring a ship in. On May the 12th, Macklin wrote, "Wind from east. Expect we will get the pack into the bay again. We do not want this, just now, with daily hope of the relief ship." There was plenty to keep them occupied, though they worked with one eye kept to seaward. There were penguins to be killed, and once in a while a seal, and there was ice to be gathered for water. They spent long hours trying to snare paddies, small pigeon-like scavenger birds which flitted around the pile of meat. An oar was made into a flagstaff and placed on the highest accessible point. From it, incongruously enough, the Royal Yacht Club Bergy stood out before the Elephant Isle gales as a signal to the anticipated relief ship. Macklin and McElroy were kept busy with patients. Kerr developed a bad tooth, and Macklin had to pull it for him. "And a grimy quack of a dentist I must have looked," wrote Macklin. "Not much refinement here. Come outside and open your mouth. No cocaine or anesthesia." Wordy's hand became infected, and Holness was troubled with a sty. Rickinson was slowly recovering from the heart attack he suffered the day they landed, but the salt water boils on his wrists stubbornly refused to heal. Greenstreet's feet, which had been frostbitten in the boats, did not improve, and he was confined to his sleeping bag. Hudson seemed in a serious way. His hands showed definite signs of healing, but the pain in his left buttock, which had begun in the boats, had developed into a very large abscess, which pained him constantly. Mentally, too, the scars of the boat journey apparently were still with him. Much of the time he lay in his sleeping bag for hours without speaking, and he seemed disinterested and detached from what was going on around him. The most serious invalid was Blackborough. His right foot appeared to be recovering, and there was hope that it might even be saved. But in the toes of his left foot, gangrene had already set in. McElroy, who was attending him, was chiefly concerned with preventing the afflicted parts from developing what is called wet gangrene, in which the dead flesh remains soft and is likely to spread infection to other parts of the body. In dry gangrene, the parts turn black and become brittle. In time, the body builds up a wall separating the living tissue from the dead, and the threat of infection is greatly reduced. McElroy was intent on seeing that Blackborough's foot remained dry, so that the separation would be complete before any operation was undertaken. More and more, as the days wore on, they fell inescapably into the routine of their existence. Each evening, before supper, they would take one final look to seaward to make certain that the dark shape of a ship or a wisp of smoke on the horizon had not been overlooked. But when they had satisfied themselves that no relief vessel was to be seen, they would go into the hut for supper. Afterward, Hussey would often play the banjo for a time. but the short period in the evening before the blubber lamps were extinguished was devoted mostly to talk. Almost anything could serve as a topic of conversation or debate, though their rescue was the primary subject, with food running a close second. Marston had a penny cookbook, and it was in constant demand. Each night he would loan it out to one group of men or another, and they would pore over it, planning the imaginary meals they would have when they got home. Aud Lees wrote one night, "We want to be fed with a large wooden spoon, and, like the Korean babies, be patted on the stomach with the back of the spoon so as to get in a little more than would otherwise be the case. In short, we want to be overfed, grossly overfed, yes, very grossly overfed, on nothing but porridge and sugar, black currant and apple pudding and cream, cake, milk, eggs, jam, honey, and bread and butter till we burst. And we'll shoot the man who offers us meat. We don't want to see or hear of any more meat as long as we live." On May the 17th, McElroy conducted a poll of the hut, asking each man what he would have if he were permitted any one dish of his choice. The results revealed that Aud Lees was right. The craving for sweets was almost unanimous, and the sweeter the better. A sampling. Clark: Devonshire dumpling with cream. James: syrup pudding. McElroy: marmalade pudding and Devonshire cream. Rickinson: blackberry and apple tart with cream. Wilde: apple pudding and cream. Hussey: porridge, sugar and cream. Green: apple dumpling. Greenstreet: Christmas pudding. Kerr: dough and syrup. There were a few men, however, whose first choice went to something other than sweets. Macklin: scrambled eggs on toast. Bakewell: baked pork and beans. Cheatham: pork, applesauce, potatoes and turnips. And Blackborough simply wanted some plain bread and butter. Green found himself the subject of much interest, because he had once been employed as a pastry cook, and the men never seemed to tire of asking him about it, especially whether he'd been permitted to eat all he wanted on the job. One night, Hurley, lying in his sleeping bag, heard Wilde and McElroy discussing food. "Do you like doughnuts?" Wilde asked. "Rather," McElroy replied. "Damned easily made, too," Wilde said. "I like them cold with a little jam." "Not bad," said McElroy. "But how about a huge omelette?" "Bally fine." Later, two of the forecastle hands were overheard by Hurley discussing some extraordinary mixture of hash, applesauce, beer, and cheese. Then Marston, referring to his cookbook, got into a heated debate with Green over whether breadcrumbs should form the base for all puddings. Through one means or another, they kept their spirits up, mostly by building dreams, but each day the ever-shortening hours of daylight told of the approach of winter. The sun now rose a little after 9 o'clock and set about 3 p.m. Since they were more than 300 miles north of the Antarctic Circle, they did not have to face the prospect of the sun disappearing altogether, but the weather was becoming increasingly cold. Macklin wrote on May the 22nd, "There is a big change in the scenery about here. Everything is now covered with snow, and there is a considerable ice foot to both sides of the spit. For the last few days, ice has been coming in, and dense pack extends in all directions as far as the eye can reach, making the chances of a near rescue seem very remote. No ship but a properly constructed ice ship would be safe in this pack. An iron steamer would be smashed up very soon. Besides this, there is very little daylight now." Indeed, the realization was spreading that, logically at least, a rescue before winter was becoming increasingly improbable, if not impossible. On May the 25th, 1 month and 1 day after the Caird had sailed, Hurley wrote, "Weather, drifting snow, and wind from east. Our wintry environment embodies the most inhospitable and desolate prospect imaginable. All are resigned now, and fully anticipate wintering." Chapter 5. They were not resigned, though. Not by any means. Perhaps logically there was so little chance for a ship to get through that it would be best to adopt an attitude of stoic resignation. But there was simply too much at stake. "Every morning," Macklin wrote on June the 6th, "I go to the top of the hill, and in spite of everything, I cannot help hoping to see a ship coming along to our relief." Even Hurley, who had been so positive, recorded that "all hands scour the skyline daily in the expectancy of a mast or plume of smoke." And though day after day no ship appeared, they attributed it to a dozen different reasons. The ice, the gales, the fog, arrangements for getting a proper ship, official delays, and all or any of these factors combined. There was almost never any mention of the most probable reason of all. The Caird had been lost. In an entry notable for its candour, Audley's wrote, "One cannot help but be a bit anxious about Sir Ernest. One wonders how he fared, where he is now, and how it is that he has not yet been able to relieve us. But the subject is practically taboo. Everyone keeps their own counsel and thinks different, and no one knows just what anyone else thinks about it, and it's quite obvious that no one really dare say what they really do think." But whatever each of them might think, there was nothing to do but to wait and hope. Each day, one man took his turn as stoker, and it was his duty to tend the fire all day, keeping it going with penguin skins and a minimum of smoke. There was also the job of outside Peggy, which entailed bringing in ice for water and gathering the necessary supplies of frozen meat to be cooked. Both tasks were tedious, and there was a fair amount of trading in order to escape them. Half a penguin steak would usually buy the services of a substitute stoker for one day. There was also a good deal of bartering in the matter of rations, and several food pools were formed. Typical of these was the sugar pool, in which each man who belonged passed up one of his three lumps of sugar each day in order to partake of a feast when his turn came around every sixth or seventh day. Wilde made no objection to this sort of thing. In fact, he permitted a wide range of flexibility in most matters. It served to avoid friction, and it gave the men something to occupy their minds. There was, on the whole, an astounding absence of serious antagonisms, considering the conditions under which they were attempting to exist. Possibly it was because they were in a state of almost perpetual minor friction. Arguments rambled on the whole day through, and they served to let off a great deal of steam which might otherwise have built up. In addition, the party had been reduced to an almost classless society, in which most of them felt free to speak their minds, and did. A man who stepped on another man's head trying to find his way out at night was treated to the same abuse as any other, regardless of what his station might once have been. This matter of going outside at night to relieve themselves was possibly the most disagreeable part of their existence. A man had to pick his way among the sleepers by the light of only a single blubber lamp, kept burning specifically for this purpose. It was almost physically impossible to avoid stepping on somebody somewhere. Then came the crawl through the hut entrance and out into weather which often approached blizzard conditions. Frequently, a man could scarcely keep his feet outside. Pieces of rock and bits of ice flew unseen through the blackness. Rather than face such a prospect, the men came to practice bladder control to the limits of bodily endurance. After a time, however, Wilde succumbed to mounting pressure, and a 2-gallon gasoline can was made into a urinal for use at night. The rule was that the man who raised its level to within 2 inches of the top had to carry the can outside and empty it. If a man felt the need and the weather outside was bad, he would lie awake waiting for somebody else to go, so that he might judge from the sound the level of the can's contents. If it sounded ominously close to the top, he would try to hold out until morning. But it was not always possible to do so, and he might be forced to get up. More than once, a man would fill the can as silently as possible, then steal back into his sleeping bag. The next man to get up would find to his fury that the can was full, and had to be emptied before it could be used. The unfortunate victim, however, could expect very little sympathy. Most of the men looked on this as a kind of practical joke,